Welcome to Michael Stone's podcast, Awaken the World. This podcast is part of an online community library we're developing, one that contains podcasts, videos, transcripts, and booklets based on Michael's talks. The goal of this library and this podcast is to bring mindfulness and mental health into the spotlight. Through this work, we're creating new ways to wake up through socially engaged, conscious, spiritual practice. We're creating a culture of compassion and collaboration. We've left our physical monasteries, and we're bringing them online. Before we get to today's podcast, I want to take a moment to ask you to consider becoming a patron of this podcast through Patreon. Pledging is easy and can be as little as $1 per month. Just go to patreon.com/Michael Stone and click on the big orange button on the top right of the page. Thank you for listening.
It's nice to be here. on Friday I taught in Madison, Wisconsin, on Saturday, Sunday, and then yesterday in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I'm glad Delta got me home with much difficulty today. There were tornadoes all day on Monday, Sunday and Monday, and so it was a long day. But, you know, it's interesting just coming and sitting down. One of the thoughts I have is I travel a lot, some of you know. And I go to the same places over and over again. Every year, maybe I only add one new place. And so there is an extended sangha to the people in the room. And I know that some of you in the room know some of these people, but a lot of you don't. And so... I've been going to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and teaching there every year for 9 years now. And also in Door County, Wisconsin, at a Zen center there. And for the past 3 years in Madison, Wisconsin. And there are groups there that meet all the time. And they listen to all the audio talks of what happens here. They study the texts. They talk with each other. I give them homework. We Skype, we email, we communicate. Andrea and Alicia and Chanel and Madison and Kathleen and Green Bay and Kathy Novice and Door County, who runs a Zen center there. Peter and Bodil and Nikolai and Heidi and Esther in Copenhagen, who get together and practice. They're all over the place. Now there's a group starting in Victoria, one in Vancouver, one in New York City. So, you know, there's kind of this extended sangha. And so for me, when I think of center of gravity, it has these webs that reach out all over. And I used to think that they begin here and they reach out, but I don't feel that way anymore. You know, now I go there and they have their own thing there that looks different. And so we try and keep the form kind of similar. But it's really wonderful. So, some of you who don't know that, it's good to know that there are other people who are practicing. Annie and Guylaine and Krista, who some of you know in Halifax, are meeting all the time and practicing. And they have a name for their sangha. It's called East of Center in Halifax. Yeah. So I was on the flight today, and you know, I don't know, Delta Airlines. So I was sitting in Detroit for about 3 hours. The flight from Toronto to Detroit is like 39 minutes, I think, or Detroit to Toronto is 39 minutes. We sat for a couple hours on the runway in a really hot plane. And so then the pilot said, just to make the plane a little cooler, just everybody shut their windows so the sun doesn't come in. You know, being in this tube, you know. And so the guy beside me looked at me and said, you must be a meditator, because I was in this tiny seat, you know, sitting with my shoes off, and so I said, yeah, a little, you know. I always try and dodge those questions on airplanes, you know, because you're kind of cornered if someone wants to start asking you questions. So I said, what do you do? He said, oh, well, I'm a scholar of Gregorian chanting. And I'm on my way to Italy to give a talk. The first time I've ever given a talk in Italian. And I've been practicing meditation for 40 years. And he's practiced a lot in Japan and all over, in India and Burma, Thailand. And so then he said, I noticed you're reading the Lotus Sutra. and I said, yeah, and then I changed the subject. No, I can't decide if I should open the window or close the window. And he said, what chapter are you on? So I said, oh, we're on the chapter on Devadatta and violence. And it's like, oh, that's a good chapter. I'm like, you know, I said, yeah, you know, last week we were talking about how there's this stupa floating in the sky, how whenever you're exploring the Lotus Sutra, a stupa appears. People here aren't noticing it, but it's there. The stupa appears, which hovers over us while we study. And he said, oh, well, that's because the fear of death, because a stupa is a funerary structure. He said, well, that's because the fear of death hovers over everyone all the time. It's what motivates us, everything that we do. So this was his interpretation, what we studied. I hadn't thought of that at all. I was interpreting last week more as like, oh, so that's what I said to him. I said, well, I didn't interpret that way. I thought it was more like life is a funeral. And he said, isn't that a song by the band? And I said, no, that's life is a carnival. And he said, same thing. So we became friends. I liked him a lot. And maybe he'll start the Ann Arbor Sangha. the carnival Sangha. Anyway, so I thought today I would just start off talking about fear. Because his interpretation or his commentary of this afternoon made me think about this. In traditional Buddhism, in the Abhidharma, it said that human beings can experience five different kinds of fear. Five different categories of fear. So I'll read the categories. And, you know, to be honest, I thought about it today on the runway. And it's hard to think of another category. Any kind of fear that arises for you probably will fall into one of these categories. So the first one is the fear of death. So this can be the fear of your own death. This can be the fear of someone else's death. And at bottom, it's the fear of the fact that this self that I am is impermanent, has an expiry date. The second kind of fear is the fear of the loss of livelihood. Now, when you go to Wisconsin nowadays, this anxiety is really close to the surface. So, in the neighborhood where I was staying, maybe 20% of the houses were foreclosed. So you walk around this neighborhood and there's all these empty houses, you know, and they're all owned by the bank. And I'm sure there is some corporation that's going and buying these houses. There has to be, you know. But the fear of the anxiety that comes when you lose your livelihood. The third is, and this is a really one you see a lot for meditators, the fear of unusual states of consciousness. I think a lot of people have this fear, the fear of going nuts, the fear of losing your mind. Or not even losing your mind, but the experience of having a mind experience reality and then start to lose its grasp on reality and experience things in the body or imaginings or hallucinations that are really terrifying. Four, fear of the loss of reputation. And the fifth, fear of speaking before a public assembly. It's kind of funny at the end that you have this one that actually seems kind of superficial in a way, but actually a lot of people have this fear. And I don't know if I can really think of a fear that's outside of it, but really you can sum them all up by, you know, a fear of a loss of something, fear of an ending, fear of change, whether it's livelihood, whether it's certain death, whether it's your reputation. And so mainly because of this fear, that's why life is like a funeral and why life is also like a carnival.
I'm surprised there's nothing like a fear of physical pain and suffering, something like that.
Could it fall into one of these categories, do you think? Fear of death? Mm-hmm. So remember, it's not just the fear of your death, but it's the fear of the way you move through your life. But yeah, you could add that maybe fear of suffering. Or, you know, how much we try and avoid suffering. But maybe the avoiding suffering is based on another one of these fears. I mean, a lot of people, when they have fear arise because of pain, what the fear is fear of loss of livelihood. You know, can't support your kids. Let's meditate on that. Maybe we can add that to the list. We'll go back in the Lotus Sutra, you can go back in time. You know, we'll just add it to the list. Yeah. Maybe we could make the Buddha look more like us. So, this chapter on Devadatta, with fear in the background and its resolution, possibly, begins with this stupa. Does everybody know what a stupa is? No? So, traditionally, the only time I've really studied, I've been to a few stupas, but one that I really love is at the Shambhala Mountain Center in, I forgot the name of the town, in Colorado. And there's this incredible stupa. And it's usually a round building. It looks like a nuclear power station. And inside it, someone could be buried. There could be, you know, priceless artifacts from someone who was important. And you would encircle this stupa. You make offerings to the stupa. It's like a massive gravestone. Yeah. And it's usually put on a sacred site, or it's placed somewhere that becomes a sacred site. And in this case, in the Lotus Sutra, in this chapter, there's a stupa that just arises naturally out of the earth. So it doesn't kind of float down from space, but it comes out of your life. And whenever you're studying the Lotus Sutra, it floats up in the sky. And it has in it the body of the Buddha. In this situation, what's happened, I want to talk about last week, but I want to get through this week, so we'll keep going. There's a stupa hovering in the sky, and the Lotus Sutra comes into some people's mind, and so the stupa stays there. And then the Buddha says, a long time ago, so he's telling a parable, a long time ago I was a king. A long time ago there was a king. And this king was, you know, doing well as a leader. There was something obviously gnawing at him. And one day, a seer came to him, a rishi, obviously some kind of religious sage, and said, if you obey me, and I am allowed to teach you, then I will teach you the great vehicle of the Lotus Sutra. That the Lotus Sutra is a great vehicle, and I will share it with you. And so the king says, okay, and the king supports him. And the king studies with him for 1,000 years. Could you imagine that? I mean, how long have you studied with your teachers? A month? One workshop, you know, at the yoga conference? So for imagine being at the yoga conference for 1,000 years. And then the king wakes up and has a realization. And then the Buddha says, do you know who that king was? That king was no other than me. I was that king in a previous life. And that sage who taught me and gave me the skills to wake up, that was no other than Devadatta. So, what's the big deal? You might think, oh, that's not such a big deal. But this is a really big deal. Because the sage is Devadatta, and Devadatta in Buddhist history is the Buddha's nemesis. Everybody needs a nemesis. And the Buddha's nemesis is Devadatta. Can you think of your nemesis? Don't say it out loud. Just think of your nemesis. So, in a past life, when you became more awake than you are now, it was only because your teacher was your present-day nemesis. Or your past nemesis is your present-day teacher. That's kind of an interesting thing to contemplate, isn't it?
But what is a nemesis?
You could say it's an enemy, or it's somebody who gets under your skin. Usually it's someone who's a lot like you. Actually. Yeah, I have a friend who's a great artist, and she said to me, you know, I like a lot of art, but nobody ever likes anyone that's doing something like they're doing.
Yeah. So could you say maybe then even your current nemesis could be your current teacher?
Yeah, for sure. Well, you see, Lotus Sutra has rubber time. So it's like, if something's happening 1,000 years ago or 1,000 years to the future, whether it's the past or the present, it's all happening now. You could also say that every enemy that you've ever had has been your teacher. And every teacher that you could ever have also can be your enemy. Maybe a good teacher is an enemy to a certain extent, because they're showing you something you don't see. It's interesting to explore. But if we just back up a little bit, one thing that's really important here is that this king decides to support this sage come hell or high water. And I think sometimes the reason why we find a teacher or someone who is a mentor is because they inspire us and we just want to hang out with them. On my way down to, I can't even remember where I was, Wisconsin, I was reading an interview, I think it was in The Guardian, with Leonard Cohen. And he was talking about, they were asking him, you know, why did you go study with Sasaki Roshi at Mount Baldy? He said, I just love the Roshi. I just love the Roshi. He called me Cohn. You know, and if any of you know the story, Leonard Cohen is actually a Roshi. He was given the job for the past 30 years, I guess, of cooking for Sasaki Roshi. And that's his job in the monastery. He's the personal cook to the Roshi. So if you're the cook, that's 3 meals a day. It's 3 meals, you're right there with the old man. I think Sasaki Roshi's 103. He's still teaching, 103 years old. You ever see pictures of him? He's like this big and really stocky. And when you see pictures of him sitting, it looks like there's just a boulder sitting on the ground. And you couldn't do anything to move him. And maybe that's why he's 103. He's not going anywhere. He is the Lotus Sutra. He is the Lotus Sutra. And I was really touched by this interview and how Leonard Cohen was saying, you know, it wasn't actually the practice or the sitting or the simple routines or getting up at 2:30 in the morning that inspired him. It was that he loved the Roshi. He just loved the man. And I feel this with my teachers. Like, I really love the practices, but more than the practices, I love them. I want to be around them whenever I can. I just planned a retreat with one of my teachers that I'm going to do for a few weeks. And every night while I was away deciding whether I should go or not, I dreamed about him. I said, okay, I'm going to go. I thought I would read the little poem at the end of the interview that Leonard Cohen wrote. This is for his teacher. It was his teacher's birthday. Some of you know this already. So he wrote his teacher. Every couple of years, he writes his teacher a poem on his birthday. So this is his poem for Sasaki Roshi. I never really understood what he said, but every now and then I find myself barking with the dog or bending with the irises or helping out in other little ways. I love this first line. I never really understood what he said. I mean, maybe you don't need to. Maybe you don't need to come here even every Tuesday night and understand the details or the analysis of the Lotus Sutra. Maybe you just need to come here and feel the Lotus Sutra and the presence of everyone here. Just like this is recorded, and the people in Madison, Wisconsin, and the people in Copenhagen and Istanbul and so on will listen to this talk, and they will be connected to you and also back to themselves without even understanding. And then you just find yourself helping out a little bit. Can I help you put the cushion back and the stool away? You look uncomfortable. Can I move that for you? You really have to pee. You go first. These are the words in the Lotus Sutra. The king at that time was I myself, and this seer was the man who is now Devadatta. All because Devadatta was a good friend to me, I was able to become fully... Would you say this about your nemesis? All because Devadatta was a good friend to me, I was able to become fully endowed with the six paramitas. Do you know the six paramitas? Some of you might know in Buddhist teachings that there are 10 paramitas, but in the Lotus Sutra there's only six paramitas. The first one is dana, which is generosity, which is where we get the word donation or giving. So we have a box, for example, over there that says dana. Someone asked me recently, why is Dana's name on the box? So this box is the box of dana, and we give generously. And every week, as we put the money into the box, we meditate on, you know, is this an amount of money that I'm giving unconsciously? You know, just throwing it in, just, you know, reach in, get some change, toss it in. Am I skipping out on giving money this week? Am I being stingy? Am I giving more than I can really give? There are people like that who just give way, way more than they can give. Or have I not really been given enough? I mean, how? The teaching is offered free, even though the rent is not free. The teachings are free. And so how can I give in a way that can support the teachings and the Sangha and so on? The next paramita is virtue or morality. The third paramita is patience or tolerance. In Sanskrit, it's kshana paramita. The fourth is virya, which is enthusiasm. The fifth one is dhyana paramita, which is concentration. And the sixth one is prajna, which is wisdom. So, what did the Buddha learn from Devadatta? This is the big deal of the story. He learned generosity, morality, patience, acceptance, enthusiasm, concentration, and wisdom. That's quite a lot. How did he learn it? He says, and then what I learned and the way I learned it from Devadatta was through the four Brahma Viharas, the four immeasurables. Loving kindness, in Pali that's metta, which is from the Sanskrit word maitri. Compassion or karuna. The third is sympathetic joy, mudita. And the fourth is upeksha or upeka in Pali, which is equanimity. It's kind of a beautiful thing. Could you reflect on studying with your enemy for 1,000 years and them teaching you all of these characteristics? Whether it's generosity, wisdom, patience. Do your enemies teach you patience? Concentration? Insight? Meeting your experience from a place of treating whatever's arising equally. So whether it's joy or whether it's pain, whether it's boredom or fascination, just meeting it with a sense of, when I think of equanimity, I often think of like the equal sign in mathematics. letting all states kind of equal one another, kind of balance each other out. It's like samastiti. So Thich Nhat Hanh was inspired by this chapter of the Lotus Sutra, and I just thought I would read what he wrote. This is from his book, Pieces Every Step. Does everybody know who Thich Nhat Hanh is? He's a Vietnamese activist and Zen teacher, now living in a monastery in the south of France that you can visit, called Plum Village. In Plum Village, where I live in France, we receive many letters from the refugee camps in Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and the Philippines, hundreds each week. It's very painful to read them, but we have to read them because we have to be in contact. We try our best to help, but suffering is enormous, and sometimes we are discouraged. It's said that half the boat people die in the ocean. Only half the boat people arrive at the shores in Southeast Asia, and even then they may not be safe. There are many young girls, boat people, who are raped by sea pirates. Even though the United Nations and many countries try to help the government of Thailand prevent that kind of piracy, sea pirates continue to inflict much suffering on the refugees. One day, we received a letter telling us about a young girl on a small boat who was raped by a Thai pirate. She was only 12. And then she jumped into the ocean and drowned herself. When you first learn of something like that, you get angry at the pirate. You naturally take the side of the girl. As you look more deeply, you will see it differently. If you take the side of the little girl, then it's easy. You only have to take a gun and you shoot the pirate. But we cannot do that. He goes on to say that he couldn't sleep and he was really upset by this, and I'm just going to skip ahead. In my meditation, I saw that if I was born in the village of the pirate and raised in the same condition he was, there's a great likelihood I would become a pirate. I saw that many babies are born along the Gulf of Siam, hundreds every day, and if we educators, social workers, politicians, and others do not do something about the situation, in 25 years a number of them will become sea pirates. That is certain. If you or I were born today in those fishing villages, we may become sea pirates in 25 years. If you take a gun and you shoot the pirate, all of us are to some extent responsible for this state of affairs. So after a long meditation, I wrote this poem. When you listen to it, there are three people, a 12-year-old girl, the pirate, and me. Can we look at each other and recognize ourselves in each other? I'll read the poem. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second, to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with wings still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in stone. Jewel in a stone. Good. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am a frog swimming happily in the clear pond, and I'm also the grass snake, who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am a child in Uganda, skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am an arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am a 12-year-old girl, a refugee on a small boat who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo, with plenty of power in my hands, and I'm the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and laughs at once, so I can see that joy and pain are one. Call me by my true names, so I can wake up, and so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion. That's Thich Nhat Hanh's commentary. One detail in the story that's left out in this version is that when the sea pirates raped this 12-year-old girl, it happened in front of her family. And then right afterwards, she jumped into the ocean and died. So imagine you receive this letter. I mean, we receive this news all the time through Facebook and the New York Times or whatever. But actually, for you to receive this letter from someone who was on the boat, who was traumatized by this. And of course, you know, imagine if this was your 12-year-old daughter. Your response would be, it would be like if it was your 12-year-old daughter. And at the same time, after Thich Nhat Hanh did this, he then has put a lot of effort into sending his monks to go in to Vietnam and into the Philippines and into Thailand to create schools and education programs for these young kids who are growing up to become sea pirates. Imagine if we could do this with our prisons. Imagine if we could take all of our prisons and turn them into monasteries. Could you imagine this? Everybody sitting together in the morning, and then maybe learning how to grow food. Maybe everyone in the prison cooking the food together. When I was in Wisconsin, every day I drove past this high security prison, maximum security prison, and there's an old sign. The prison was built in like 1860 something, and it's like the Don Jail, you know, where it still has that look. But it's probably in this one in Wisconsin, you could imagine like the Don Jail, really crowded and loud. Dirty. And I noticed the sign on the cornerstone that said 1860 whatever had a sign, and it was called the reformatory. That's what they called the prison when they built it, a reformatory. So there's not much to say after the Thich Nhat Hanh story. I think he really sums it up. We all have a nemesis. And I think we all have a nemesis we want to lock away. Don't we? Don't you all have someone you want to send away for a while? Or maybe you're away for a while. Yeah. And the Buddha is saying, well, I could never really, deeply, find in me the quality of generosity until I learned from Devadatta. So I thought I would just tell you who Devadatta is. This is Gene Reeves. According to many stories, Devadatta was the son of King Supabuddha, and his wife Pamita was an aunt of the Buddha. So that means his sister, Yasodhara, was the Buddha's wife, making him both a cousin and a brother-in-law to the Buddha. Those are the worst nemesis. They're actually related to you, and they're going to be at the Seder. Together with Ananda and others, he became a monk. This is Devadatta, early in the Buddha's ministry. It said he was a very good monk, known for his grace and psychic and magical powers. So that's the worst kind of nemesis also. Not only are they related to you, but they're really good at what they do. And they're successful and they're graceful. And then only later did he become greedy for power and start making trouble for the Buddha. One day, in a large assembly, Devadatta approached the Buddha and asked to be made the leader of the Sangha. So the two worst things you can do to gain, you know, if you want to incur the worst karma, the worst thing you can do, period, is try and kill a Buddha. And the second worst thing you can do is split up a community. Just so you know. So, Devadatta is said to have become very angry, vowing to take revenge on the Buddha. He had followers, one of whom was Ajatasattu. Together, they planned to kill both Ajatasattu's father, King Bimbisara, and Devadatta's enemy, the Buddha. According to legend, according to legend, the first attempt to kill the Buddha involved a complicated plot to hire a man to kill the Buddha who would in turn be killed by two other men, who would in turn be killed by four other men, who would then be killed by eight other men. But when the first man came close to the Buddha, he became so frightened. He put down his weapons and became a follower of the Buddha, and eventually all the men down the line came to kill the Buddha and eventually saw the transformation of the previous murderer and decided to become followers of the Buddha. Another attempt to kill the Buddha, it happened three times, is said to have happened on Holy Eagle Peak, where the Lotus Sutra and many other sutras are supposed to have been preached by the Buddha. From above the Eagle Peak, there is a platform one-fourth of the way down the mountain. You can go there and see this. Devadatta pushed a huge stone down the platform and threw it down at the Buddha. And on its way, it struck someone else. A small piece flew off and hurt the Buddha's foot, causing it to bleed, but without doing any serious damage, except to the karma of Devadatta. The last attempt involved getting a fierce elephant drunk. When the elephant, and if you know this story, there's a couple details about it. One is that this one elephant that they got drunk had six tusks. Remember we studied this a few weeks ago? And also, elephants used to congregate in elephant caves. And apparently in Sri Lanka, there are these caves where the mineral content in the wall of the cave is very high. And so elephants like to go in the caves and chew on the minerals in the inside of the caves. So the caves can get really crowded with elephants. But the caves also got really smooth. And so that's, they would become holy. And that's where the meditators used to go, into elephant caves, because the walls were so smooth. But it was dangerous in the construction process. When the elephant saw the Buddha coming to the cave, the elephant raised its ears, trunks, and tusks and charged at him. But when the elephant came close, the Buddha radiated compassion towards the elephant, causing it to stop, get sober, and become quiet. Have you ever done this? Maybe to a parent, you know. The Buddha then stroked its trunk and whispered to it softly. The elephant took its trunk and some dust and scattered it around the Buddha's feet, and then went away and complained and remained completely tame from that time on. Aren't those good? So that Devadatta is a bad guy. A really, really bad guy. Here's what Dogen says. When an ordinary person realizes it, she is a sage. When a sage realizes it, she's an ordinary person. It's kind of beautiful, isn't it? So, when you wake up to this possibility of having compassion, even for those that we scapegoat, even for those parts of us that we compartmentalize, then you become a sage. Yeah? In other words, you allow everything in and to be part of your practice. And then, When a sage wakes up, she's just ordinary. It's back to ordinary life. And this is this theme we get over and over in the Lotus Sutra. That we're on this really bad and bumpy road, sometimes alone, sometimes with community, sometimes with thugs. And you never know who you're going to meet, but the path is the road. And every time we think there's a treasure, we realize when we get there that it was just a treasure that helped us move forward along the road. The career, the family, the letting go of your career, your yoga teacher training, your letting go of your yoga teacher training. These are all just phantom toll booths on the road. And where's the road heading? Well, it's like a Möbius strip. It's heading back into itself. And here we are, like halfway through the Lotus Sutra, and we still haven't even heard about the Lotus Sutra. And Nichiren, who I believe is in the same century as Dogen, he really felt terrible in his life from his past. He had this kind of Protestant kind of guilt. And his main practice was just chanting the Lotus Sutra. The title. Maybe in English, it's Dharma Flower Sutra. Or Dharma Flowering. And you just chant this all the time. And you don't even study the Lotus Sutra, you just chant it. You just chant the name Lotus Sutra. It's good enough. In some schools, they take the text, they put it in a room, and then they sit there for 21 days. There's a couple references to this. I think we passed them already. This 21-day ritual, where you sit in the same room as the Lotus Sutra for 21 days, and every day at the end of the day, you confess your sins. So this is kind of interesting. In other words, the Lotus Sutra, again, they're not studying it. It's just sitting in the room with you, supporting you. And then some people, they just take the actual Lotus Sutra and they just turn it 21 times. Isn't that kind of beautiful? Maybe it's like type A people, they're just like so busy, you know, trying to find more oil. They don't have time to study the Lotus Sutra, so they just turn it 21 times and they get the same benefit. Anyways, I wrote a little poem on the airplane. This is my response to Thich Nhat Hanh. Palestine, the state of Israel. Israel at the bar, all of us at the bar, drunk on power. My mother, in Israel, raising money again for victims of terror. Isn't it easy to say it? Terrorist? It's like your wrist, or mine, a heart. War helps people feel good about themselves, and country is a term to measure that failure. That's for my mom. Any comments or questions before we finish chanting? This chapter is a lot longer. But actually, I learned recently that it used to be split up. And at some point, and nobody can agree on when, the two different stories in the chapter got put together. So next week we're going to do the second half of the chapter, which is about an 8-year-old girl. And there's a very famous koan about her. And so next week we'll study that section and learn the koan. If you're wondering why we only got to half the chapter. So any questions or comments before we wrap up? Yeah.
Why is that the book The Lotus Sutra, sort of like Bible for the Buddha?
Yeah, the Lotus Sutra is a text that wasn't written in the Buddha's time. It was compiled... we don't know when it was compiled, but it was translated From Sanskrit to Chinese in 406 AD. So it's really old. And yeah, it's basically like a Bible. The problem with it is that the whole text... Oh, I don't want to give away the text. But we're halfway through the text, and the whole text has been about how the Buddha is about to preach the Lotus Sutra, and what will happen. Like, a stupa will show up, it'll start raining, beams of light will come. But we still haven't heard the teaching of the Lotus Sutra yet. Or maybe we have. It's really hard to say.
Why is it called Lotus Sutra?
We don't know yet. Yeah. Still getting there. That's why people say, you know, what are you studying? Studying the Lotus Sutra. Well, what's happening?
Well, lotus is like a flower, right? Mm-hmm. And sutra, what does sutra mean?
It's a text. Philosophical text.
Nervous to say something because I'm thinking of the people in Copenhagen.
But... Uh-huh. Yeah. They're really, really, really intelligent. Have you ever been to Copenhagen?
No.
Everybody has a PhD. University is free. It's completely free there. You sit in a room and everyone has a doctorate. So what was your comment?
Well, I was thinking about my nemesis and thinking about this kind of fallen angel / Wile E. Coyote nemesis of the Buddhas,
yeah.
And just thinking how insignificant my nemesis and some of the lessons. Like, it's just interesting thinking about the scale of this nemesis,
yeah.
Who was so brilliant and
yeah.
Who was so cunning in his attempts. Then thinking about when you were pointing at our thinking of our own nemesis, they're so small in their little differences.
Like your internal.
Well, just even the real person, you know, like, you know, Rose is my nemesis, you know, they're so lovely, you know, in general.
Yeah.
It's funny to think about finding an actual nemesis, someone to really sink your teeth into.
Yeah.
You actually do hate. And so anyway, I'm just it's interesting things with fodder for this. Things that are actually much closer.
Yeah.
Those of us are privileged much to have a real nemesis in our life.
Yeah, I mean, I like to do this sometimes with like politicians, you know? Like just to like close your eyes and picture, you know, Stephen Harper playing ball with his son, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And like how there's something he does where he's probably some really good man. And to really try and meditate on that. I was thinking about this because I've been hanging out at the new monk library a lot this month. And you know, you just can't think too much about how that library came to be. And yet you're in this beautiful library. So how can we hold both sides of these? Yeah. Go on.
But I feel like a nemesis can really just as easily be somebody that you don't really even know. Just, you know, it most of the time I feel like it's somebody who hasn't even done anything to you. It's just something, a person that you can like obsess about.
Oh yeah.
Based on like something that you think you may know about them.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like, I mean, I don't know how many people really have somebody who has like really harmed them.
Yeah. In this story, remember all that whole list of fears,
mm-hmm.
right? Fear of death, fear of losing your reputation. Devadatta did all of that to the Buddha. Every single one of those things. So yeah, I mean, there are some nemesis that are kind of invisible, and maybe even it's mostly your own projection. And then there are some people, and they're out to get you. I mean, that's good to think about. Like, have you ever had somebody? I've had this experience where there's someone who's out to get you. It's really awful. It makes you lose your faith in human beings, if you had any. To begin with. Yeah. Okay.
But isn't Mara the Buddha's nemesis, or is Mara, because Mara seems to take on the form.
Yeah, you could say they're the same. Except, you know, this is written like 700 years later, after the Mara stories. Some people argue, and this is getting into a bit of scholarship, but some people argue that the Devadatta stories actually were added later, just to create a story of a nemesis for the Buddha. Yeah, but, you know, he doesn't have one nemesis. Devadatta is like one of many. Mara is also that which tortures him. The closer he gets to freedom, the more he gets tortured. One more comment, someone who hasn't had a chance yet. A man? Or a woman in a man body? Yes, a woman in a man body.
about this nemesis, interesting that you're talking about this. I found that I never, or I didn't have an impression of ever creating enemies or nemesis.
Yeah.
And they misinterpret what it is I think you are doing.
Yeah.
And now it seems I have nemesis.
Nemesi? Yeah.
And I don't know how to help them other than just continuing to be me.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment, because how do you help them when the aggression is coming towards you?
They want me to engage sometimes in this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, Thich Nhat Hanh's meditating and all he can think about is getting a gun. And that's not what he does. He ends up going and building a school. So how's he helping them? Well, he's helping them, first of all, by recognizing in himself how he's caught and how he wants to get a gun. Han, get your gun. He doesn't. Yeah. And most of us, you know, we don't have that capacity in our meditation to be able to stop ourselves from getting the gun. For most of us, we go get the gun. Hopefully most of you not literally getting a gun, but a lot of us probably come pretty close, right? To be so angry, you want to just shut something down. And you know, that's why, you know, maybe in history, why so many Buddhists really have this history of compassion towards enemies. I mean, you know, for all the controversy around the Dalai Lama, I mean, he's still been a pretty incredible leader. And I mean, to have a leader in this world that is as well known as the Dalai Lama, who doesn't even have his own country, doesn't even have an army, it's pretty, we're not used to seeing that. Did you have your hand up?
I had one comment, I guess, to make. It reminds me of, in a different tradition, in the Tolteca tradition, there's the idea of the petty tyrant. And aligning yourself with the petty tyrant.
Yeah.
What nemesis makes me think of, kind of, in order to learn all the things that the Buddha learns from Theravada.
Yeah.
Like to kind of consciously put yourself into a place where there's that difficulty with another being.
Yeah.
And to find compassion in it, and to find all those things to be able to meet them that way.
Yeah.
And not give them the power.
Yeah, I mean, when I drove from Madison to Green Bay, it's a 3-hour drive, it was on Sunday night, and the sky was pink and purple, and there was a tornado. And have you ever seen this? I've never seen this before. So, like, there's these clouds, and they come really low down to the ground, and they're purple, and then everything's pink, and you see these lines. And they're like those lines. And they have these sirens everywhere in Madison that are going off because it's a tornado sirens. And just to think about all the people who have farms there, who every year during tornado season decide to stay put and like really be there on the land. And maybe some people say it's foolish and they get their barn ripped off or their, and they stay there and they really know the land. Maybe all of us, you know, are practicing because we have these tornadoes, you know, and they come at us and we like are trying to hide, get in the basement, get in the, and like we're learning how to like dig in. And be here for them in our relationships, in our bodies, in our life. And maybe this is how faith develops. To actually pick a piece of land and really dig in. Okay, so I want to keep talking, except I promise I would end on time today. So we'll continue next week. We have a great second half of this chapter next week. An 8-year-old girl is going to get enlightened. Even though she's a girl. She's going to get enlightened. So let's finish chanting. Life and death are of supreme importance.
Life and death are of supreme importance.
Time passes swiftly and opportunity is lost.
Time passes swiftly and opportunity is lost.
Let us awaken.
Let us awaken.
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 Do not squander your life.
Do not squander your life.
May all beings be happy.
May all beings be happy.
May all beings be healthy.
May all beings be healthy.
May all beings be safe and free from danger.
May all beings be safe and free from danger.
May all beings be free from their ancient and twisted karma.
May all beings be free from their ancient and twisted karma.
May all beings be free from every form of suffering.
May all beings be free from every form of suffering.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Thank you for being here. Please don't forget the Donna box. Can you point out the Donna box? Right there. Dana's box. And secondly, please email me through Center of Gravity website if you have any suggestions for chartered accountants who have experience with charitable organizations. Okay, class dismissed.
Thank you for listening to Michael Stone's podcast, Awaken the World. If you like this podcast, you can support it by subscribing on iTunes or SoundCloud. Please take a moment to rate us and leave a comment. Your feedback helps to distinguish us from the pack. You can also support us by word of mouth, tell a friend, or send a tweet. Finally, please consider becoming a patron of this podcast through Patreon at patreon.com/Michael Stone. Even a couple of dollars a month will help us reach our goals. To learn about Michael's retreats and his online courses, go to michaelstoneteaching.com. Once again, that's michaelstoneteaching.com. With your support, we'll continue to build a community library about mindfulness and mental health that can be shared with the world. Thank you for supporting this community without walls.